Jim Riley, you arrive in the Northern Territory as a young vet. Who is your employer?
The Northern Territory Administration Department of Territories. Yes, I arrived in Darwin in the middle of the wet season, and I climbed out of the milk run Fokker Friendship, came down the steps, and was overwhelmed by the steam rising off the tarmac and the overpowering smell of frangipani. It just hit me, and I've never forgotten that smell.
What was your first couple of weeks like on the job suddenly at the other end of Australia?
Interesting. I met my colleagues. They were all very friendly, as Territorians are. I was introduced to the alcohol culture. And then about day two or three, Senior Stock Inspector North, Naish Ganley, came to me and said, Jimmy, he said, get your tuberculosis testing gear together. We've got 4,000 cattle to test at Sturt Plain. It's only about 600 miles south, and then it's about 100 miles inland.
4,000 cattle. Was that a kind of a normal job?
Yeah, reasonably normal. Anything from 1,000 to 10,000, yeah. Naish was there to bleed them. I was there to TB test them. So I got me stuff together, and this is a story which makes me think that there must be a God. So down the track we went, and Naish, who was a raging drinker, we deviated every 20 miles to the left or the right to some backwater hostelry. Eventually, 2 days later, we got down to the Sturt Plain turnoff. We turned into the dirt road, and I thought I'd check my gear. My beautiful little McClintock syringe, which is a very high-tech piece of equipment, which delivered 0.1 mils of tuberculin test, intradermal, not subcut, but intradermal, under very high pressure. It had special needles, very, very, very special needles that took the high pressure. So I'm going through my gear, and goodness me, I've left my box of needles on my desk in Darwin. The guts fell out of me. Here I was 700 miles out of Darwin, and I had the most vital piece of equipment missing. They had mustered the cattle over a period of 6 or 8 weeks with horses, and I couldn't do the tests. I was unable to do the tests, but we camped a mile short of the station, and I'm shivering in fear, wondering what I'll tell Naish and the stock people at the station, whether I'll be strung from the nearest tree or what. And I didn't tell Naish, the senior stock inspector. I got under my swag and pulled the covers over the top of me because the nights there were very cold. It hadn't rained for about 2 years on Sturt Plain at the time, not a single drop. And around about 2 a.m., I heard a couple of noises on the swag which I had over the top of me. It just went... And then, 30 seconds later, the heavens opened up. And between 2 a.m. and dawn, we had 4 inches of rain. I didn't get wet because I had a really good swag. Anyway, at dawn, the head stockman came in on his horse because we'd camped a mile short of the station, as we always did because we didn't sponge on station hospitality. And he rode up on the horse in the half daylight and said, "G'day, Naish. G'day, young fella." "Naish," he said, "the bloody cattle are up to their bellies in mud in the holding paddocks. We can't even move them." And he said, "Naish, would it be all right if we postponed this a few weeks?" Naish said, "Oh, yeah, I suppose so." And "he'd be all right with you, young fella?" "Yes," I said, "yes, for sure. For sure." So I said to myself, there must be a God. That was the first job I ever did.
You camped rather than sponging off the station. That's really interesting. Why?
Because it was our tradition. After we'd done the job, if we were invited back to the station, then we would go. But you would never roll up, as some departments did, and expect hospitality because it was just not right. But what you did do when you went there to such places, you always chucked a few loaves of fresh bread in and newspapers, recent newspapers, so that you gave them to the station. And if you were invited back the next day after you finished your work, say 3 or 4 days later, then yes, you accepted.
What was the standard set of equipment you ended up needing as a vet in this circumstance where you're going to have to travel a long time, you're going to have to camp. What did you end up having to buy that a vet in modern day Tasmania wouldn't need?
Well, I didn't have to buy anything. It was all issued to me by the Department of Territories. As there were no private vets in the Northern Territory then, except for one domestic pet vet in Darwin, we had to carry everything, because when you did go to a station, they would say, oh, while you're here, would you mind spaying this cat and these few dogs, or and this horse is a bit lame, and so on. And so, as well as the government job, you would usually end up doing half a dozen private jobs, but you didn't get paid for it because that was the way it was.
So did you get a ute and camping gear and food to take when you were camping and all that sort of thing?
Yep, sure did. I was issued with a swag, I was issued with a tucker box, I was issued with 8 jerry cans, old metal jerry cans, and I did have to buy my own food to put in the tucker box, and I had to buy my own Cummins and Campbell OP rum, which is another story. You could stay out bush for 4 months. I remember that the left-hand front hubcap of my ute, old Falcon ute, used to be the dog's drinking bowl. I carried a cattle dog with me called Fred. She was a girl, but I called her Fred anyway. The right-hand hubcap was, I think, my bogey bowl for shaving in. Then there was one at the back which I used for cooking, and the other one was still clean.
That was the spare.
Yeah, that was exactly.
You would have faced some real danger, I think, being out. Dirt roads, the middle of nowhere, snakes and all sorts of things.
Oh, damn snakes, they were no trouble. But you've just reminded me of something that happened on Agadagada Station down near Alice Springs. I'd travelled in about, I suppose, 100 miles into the west towards Queensland, almost to Queensland, and I decided to pull over to a turkey's nest dam that was on my map. So I pulled the ute that I had at that time over near the turkey's nest and took a bucket with me to get some water out of the dam. And it was about 150 metres from my car to the dam in the dark, and I heard a couple of growls. Now, there hadn't been any rain for 8 years in Alice Springs at this time in the late 1960s. And I looked around with, I had a torch, and I looked around and I saw a pair of eyes looking at me, a big black dingo. And I thought, oh, well, g'day, mate, you're not a worry, because dingoes don't really bother you. And then I spun the torch around and I saw another set of eyes, and then another set of eyes, and they're all creeping up on me. I believe that Lindy Chamberlain was absolutely right. Anyway, so I thought, oh, I think I'm in trouble. So spinning the torch into the leader's eyes and various other dogs' eyes, I backed off slowly, one step at a time, towards the vehicle, jumped in and slammed the door. And I did not camp there that night.
What was the longest you were ever away from home?
Oh, about 4 months.
4 months on the road.
Yeah. And sometimes aeroplane too.
You must have had a fine head of hair by the end of 4 months on the road.
Every now and again, you might come across a station where the lady might have snipped your hair. I don't remember that. Yeah.
The general state of hygiene is what I'm actually thinking about there, Jim.
That was easy to fix. That was easy. The old Falcon utes had, when you lifted the bonnet, they had a long rod. And in the end of the rod, there was a little bit of a hook. And if you lifted the bonnet, pulled the rod out, pointed it up about 45 degrees in the air, and then put the bonnet back down, you would put your galvanised bucket with 4 nail holes in the bottom of it on that, fill it with water first, and then stand under it and have a bogey.
Did the government know you had a pilot's licence and start kind of making use of you that way, or is that something that you started doing off your own bat, becoming the flying vet?
When I was in the Oster, I used to get paid 10 cents an air mile, 10 cents an air mile to fly on the job in my Oster. But, I used to get a little bit of money. It was hardly enough to pay the fuel, but, yeah.
You must have had some hairy landings in the middle of the Northern Territory on farms that were 1,000 kilometres away.
Indeed.
What was the worst one?
None of them were crashes, but certainly I landed the Oster and the Tiger many times in a set of wheel tracks, and then had to check that the wheel tracks were approximately the same distance as the tyres of the aeroplane. And many, well, I was able, because of very, very good training, I think, I was able to land my Oster in about 30 or 40 metres, and later on the Tiger in about 60 metres, you just stick the nose up in the air and have the power on bloody near full and sort of huff full out of the sky and go thump. It's called a full power landing.
What about the takeoff in someone's wheel ruts? How hard were they to do?
Oh, I don't remember any difficulties, really. I was reasonably well-trained and a little bit daring, I suppose. A little bit too daring, maybe.
Well, that daring eventually took you across the sea to Timor.
Oh, dear me. I shouldn't talk about this.
Are you going to talk about it, Jim, though?
All right.
So what were you doing flying to Timor?
I didn't. I was navigator and bomb aimer and parachutist. I mean, I didn't jump out, but I chucked the parachutes out. Sarah Henderson wrote a number of lovely books out of Bulow River Station. Charlie Henderson was her husband. He was a man of high principles, principles which sometimes were a little bit over-principled, maybe. And in his abattoir, he had a freezer set up as well. And we loaded up the old Beaver double its capacity, I would suggest, and with frozen meat, all attached with parachutes, small parachutes, and flew over to East Timor, me navigating, and in the dark, and we had to find three fires in the mountains, and the three fires were in a triangle, and we had to drop the parachutes maybe 20 or 30 frozen cartons of meat in them. But the thing which was very, very interesting was some of the parcels I pushed out were long in boxes and smelled rather military.
So who were this stuff being dropped to?
To Fretland and his forces.
Did you know that's what you were doing at the time, or were you just doing a favour for Charlie?
I was into anything.
Can you describe a beaver and the distance you went in that beaver?
Oh, golly, it's not very far to East Timor, about 500, I suppose, or 400. I can't quite remember. But it took about 2 hours flying time, so no, it would have been less than that. And the beaver is a big single-engine radial workhorse. It's supposed to carry a ton, but I reckon we were carrying two. Yeah, it was bloody good fun. Johnny Gabriel was the pilot, and he was as crazy as I am. I don't think he's still alive. He proposed to my sister, actually, when he flew an aeroplane down. I mean, that's another story.
Was she wise enough to say no?
I think she almost went there. But he'd only met her for 5 minutes.
He must have been a very tempting man. What sort of social life do you end up having when you spend so much time travelling away? Is your work just your entire life?
Yes, pretty well. Time-wise it is, yes, yes. In the territory it was, which is why a later wife of mine said she was never going back again, ever, ever, ever again. But she went back for one more year with me.
What did she object to? Just her being alone, essentially, there?
Yes. Alone and looking after her three kids that I inherited, plus our two that we'd made. So that was hard work, bloody hard work alone, in the stinking hot tropical heat. In the middle of the wet season, I used to be transferred down south with the government. And when we were due to go back, we were walking out, the family was walking out to the steps of the Fog of Friendship. Where was it? In Canberra, I think. At the foot of the steps, she said, "I'm not going back. I am not going back." And she said, "I'm not even rising, I'm not even putting a foot on those steps." She'd been holding back to tell me that for some time. So I said, "Oops, all right." So we went back to the terminal, made our excuses. I rang up my headquarters and they said, "All right, okay. If she doesn't want to go back, I believe there's a position in Tasmania coming up in 8 months' time. How about you ask her if she'd go back for one more year?" So I put that to her and she said, "Yes, okay, but that's it." So I came to Tasmania after that, based in Devonport, stayed there another 3 or 4 years until my time was up with the government, and then I went into teaching and then private practice.
How was that swap over, becoming a private practitioner after working for the government all that time?
Yeah, bloody hard, actually. I had to do a lot of upgrading.
Where was your first private practice?
In Forth. Set it up from scratch.
There's a lot of equipment in setting up a private vet practice, isn't there?
Indeed there is, but we gradually raised our facilities and equipment, and if I wasn't able to handle something for the first few years, I referred it.
Did you like dealing with dogs and cats and lots of people after all those years of being in the middle of musters?
People, yes. Dogs and cats were not my favourite operation, but I liked it. But my love was outdoors, horses, cattle, sheep. Yeah.
Was there always enough of that to keep you interested in Forth?
Flat out. Absolutely flat out. 4 o'clock in the morning, after not getting to bed until 11, a telephone call, cow calving. You'd fall onto the floor on your hands and knees, utterly knackered, and stay on your hands and knees until you started to come awake, and then get dressed and go out and do it. But it came good, because when you had a nice little steaming calf lying on the ground in the straw, it wasn't so bad.
Do you have any particularly memorable patients from your time in Forth?
Yeah, one's an interesting story, but a wildlife park brought in a wedge-tailed eagle to me, which had become tangled in a barbed wire fence, and it twisted and twisted and twisted and twisted until its wing had died. And they said, could you take the wing off? And I said, this is an eagle. It's supposed to fly. That's all it's supposed to do. And they said, well, please, we've got a fantastic wildlife park. We can look after it and make it very happy. And reluctantly, I amputated the wing and it went back. I did keep in contact, and they said it's very happy. It's hopping around. It jumps all over the very big aviary from branch to branch, but it can't fly, of course. And then about 6 years later, the wildlife park rang me up and said, he's died, that eagle, at last. And I said, right, do you know what I've got in the shed? His other wing. For some reason, I hung it up in the shed. I don't know why. And I said, we cannot bury this eagle and let him go to eagle heaven without his wing. So I took the wing out to the wildlife park and we buried him with his wing so that he could fly in eagle heaven.
You kept flying as well when you came to Tasmania, didn't you? What sort of thing were you doing with your plane? Were you working in it or were you doing it for fun?
No. I did a lot of wilderness flights. We used to call them wilderness watch flights. For the Wilderness Society, I flew taking photographs of illegal logging coops and submitting them to the government and to the Wilderness Society, who made reports on them, because I'm a raging greenie, unfortunately. There was that, and of course joyrides, and I flew every week pretty well, and I had to take the tiger moth up at least once a week to do an aerobatic flight, because you couldn't wipe the smile off my face after an hour's aerobatics for about half an hour.
How old is the design of a tiger moth?
Well, if you go back to the moths came around at about 1920, the moth series, but the tiger itself, I think, first was about 1920. 56 or 7, and then that was the Gypsy, and then the Tiger in the early 30s, and then it was used as a RAF trainer.
It's such an old plane, and yet they're still being used for aerobatics. What is it about the Tiger Moth that makes it so good for that sort of thing?
So resilient. It's a bit like your axe, which has had 10 new heads and 10 new handles. It's still the same axe, but it's been replaced in many parts. Yeah, you need to maintain it, and if anything's not quite right, you change it for one that is right.
And you made a lot of those parts yourself, by the sound of it.
I did, yes. Sometimes I've found throughout the chicken sheds and hangars of southeastern Australia, I found bits that were not exactly up to scratch, so I copied them. I didn't copy them. I had them copied because, you know, I needed... I took them to an engineer who I said what I wanted, and that happened.
For example, a wing. What is a wing like? What are they made of in a tiger moth?
Mm-hmm. There's a main spruce beam, I suppose. I can't remember the name. And a secondary one. And then there's fore and aft wooden devices shaped like exactly like a wing. And then over the top of all of that is stitched fabric.
So it is made of timber and canvas, and yet still being used these days to do acrobatics.
Yeah.
You used to actually do fundraising in your tiger moth, didn't you?
How did you find that out?
You texted me.
Oh, a long time ago. It was a long time ago. Yeah.
I've just been going through our text trail.
Oh,
Jim.
Right. Okay. The Forth Primary School was down to about 70 students and it was about to be closed. I proposed an idea for fundraising. And so I advertised in the newspaper that we would be dropping 1,000 packets of potato chips on the Forth School Fair. and that went into the newspaper a few times before the fair. And although the fair had only raised a couple of $1,000 for year after year after year, the first year that the tiger appeared, it firstly dropped in three bombing runs about 1,000 packets of potato chips at a reasonably low height, I must say. And then there was a competition, where I had to drop a flour bag over the side and hit a big target, and everybody had to pay money to guess how close I was going to get to the target. And then after I'd done the drops, I went over a little way away, just far enough away to make it not an official display, and I did a series of aerobatics for people to watch, but certainly not over the school, because I would have been illegal not being a pilot who is registered to do aerobatics over a crowd or near a crowd.
Are you still flying now?
I'm able to, but I haven't done for a little while.
You still have a plane?
No.
Now, what happened to your Tiger Moth?
I sold it to a good mate. He crashed his. He then sold it to Western Australia, where it was pulled down and totally rebuilt.
What's stopping you from getting into a plane now and having some fun, doing some aerobatics?
Right now, until I have my knees replaced, I'm taking painkillers for knee arthritis, which preclude me from flying.
Once the knees are the new knees are banged in, you're going to be up again?
I reckon, yeah.
You have a story about a tetanus horse, I'm told, Jim.
Oh, yes, that was a funny old story. Have we got half an hour?
We do, in fact.
All right, okay. Paddy was his first name, not the horse, but the farmer. He called me up on the phone, which in those days was went through the exchange, and you had this little windy thing where you rang people up and you talked to them. He said, "Me old horse," it was his working horse. He said, "He's so stiff he can't move, and he's down in the old shed, in the old homestead." I said, "Oh, sounds like it's tetanus to me." So I went out there with my rifle, and it was a horrible night. The wind and sleet was horizontal. We had to walk out from the station, from the homestead, about half a mile across the moors, and we ended up at an old building, which was an old falling down house. And we went in with the torch. Here was this poor old Clydesdale, stiff as a board and standing like a sawhorse. And I said, "Paddy, it's terrible. He's got tetanus." He said, "Oh, dear me, what do you do?" And I said, "I'm afraid we have to put him down, mate." "All right." And because I expected it, I actually had the rifle with me, the old 303, and I shot him. Paddy said, "Jimmy, you missed." And I said, "Paddy, I couldn't have missed. I'm only 2 feet away." I said, "Look at the hole in the middle of his skull. It's right where I wanted to shoot him." And I said, "Paddy, I know what's going on. He's so bloody stiff, he won't fall over." "Oh, be blowed," he said. And he said, "I just happened to have a bottle of homemade whiskey in my pocket. Maybe we should have one and give him a bit of a wake." I said, "Yeah, good idea." And the rain was pelting down outside horribly. About an hour later, we'd finished the bottle, and Paddy said, "Well, Jimmy, we can't just leave him standing there, can we?" And I said, "No, probably not. He should be lying down if he's dead, shouldn't he?" I said, "Oh, yeah, righto, let's push him over." So we pushed him over, but it just so happened that the main wall in the middle of the house happened to be holding up the roof, and the horse hit it and brought the entire establishment down around our ears. And we crawled out, and Paddy said, "Well, I think I might have another bottle up at the house. We should go home, shouldn't we?" I said, "Yeah, let's go. Yeah, jolly good." So up we went, and a few days later there'd been a bit of dry weather, and I saw some smoke rising down near the sand dunes near the sea where the old house was. So I pulled in, and Paddy was lying underneath the tractor. And I said, "Paddy, what's going on down there?" He said, "I couldn't just leave him there, so I give him a Viking's funeral. So I poured a whole lot of diesel over the old house and lit it."
I would love to go that way. Bulldoze the house around me and send it up with some diesel.
Yeah.
Jim, I've got a couple of other questions I have to ask you from your text trail.
Uh-oh.
I've been told to ask you about old Brian, the stock camp cook at Lake Nash Station on the Queensland border.
Yeah. Remember I told you about those dingoes that backed me off 150 metres into the car?
Yep.
Well, that was on the way up to Lake Nash. And I arrived at Lake Nash the next day, and to TB test a big mob of cattle. And you TB test them, and you're so far from home, you've got to wait 4 days between the needles that you give the cattle in the caudal tail fold, and when you read them to see if they're positive or not. And in those 4 days, you had very little to do except read books. And old Brian, the camp cook, and I were the only blokes in the stock camp. He had this gigantic big pot on the fire, which he called perpetual stew. The stock camp had been going for months. And if you dug deeply enough, you might have got a piece of meat from the bottom, which was 6 months old. but I'm sure it wouldn't have mattered. But then again, the more funny thing was that on Sundays, this particular Sunday, he made brownie. And brownie is, instead of just making bread, it's like a fruitcake with sultanas and really fancy stuff. And he even used yeast in it, which made it rise. So he'd made the brownie, which was about 2 foot across, and he took it over to his springy old bed, and he laid it in the camp oven on his bed for it to rise. And every fly in creation landed on it and got stuck. And I looked at him later on when it had risen, and he was taking it back to the fire and putting the lid on the top of it with all of the flies on top. And he looked up at me and gave me a wink, and he said, guess what, he said, you can't tell the bloody difference between the flies and the sultanas when it's cooked.
Did you become a good camp cook yourself after all those years of wandering around?
No, I'm still not a good cook. I try, but I'm not a good cook.
How did you keep body and soul together when you're on the road for 4 months at a time?
Oh, Cummins and Campbell rum, canned stuff, a little bit of station hospitality occasionally. Yeah, it's not that hard.
What is your favourite place to fly over in Tasmania?
The Needles.
Why is that?
They're beautiful. Down south. I just fly around them in circles, and in my old Oster, I did that. I'd just like to say a couple of things.
Mm.
I'm really, really proud of my two kids, David Riley, who's, of course, was a journo with the ABC and doing features as well. I went to the UK as a vet for 2 years, and I had my turf umpires certificate, and I remember Tom played for one of the city cricket teams, and when Tom fired up, the team would always win, and when Tom didn't fire up, the team may not have. He was a very good bowler and a bloody brilliant batsman. And I was umpiring. Unfortunately, I was umpiring on this particular match, and he was facing up, and he was on zero. The first ball went through, and nobody appealed. About 5 seconds later, before the ball was back in the bowler's hand, second slip said, excuse me, sir, how's that? And I replayed it in my mind. I said, no deflection, no noise, no nothing, not out. And my brilliant son, Tom, he looked at me. He peeled one glove off, and then he peeled the other batting glove off, and then he tucked the bat under his arm, gave me a nod, and walked. Oh, golly, I was so proud of him. I was so proud of him.
Jim Riley, I'm so glad you finally came down to Hobart to talk to me. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, John.